This JP Parise story was extraordinarily depressing. You were very close to it. What's been your journey through this story in the last couple of weeks?
As you mentioned, I mean, it's just been horrible watching Zach have to battle through this. I think it says a lot about him. The way he has handled this, it has been a really downhill, hard thing to watch for the last month and a half. JP was, first of all, he didn't want to do the chemotherapy in the first place when he was given this diagnosis a year ago. But I think, he felt like he had to fight. But he survived prostate cancer in 1999, and he just didn't, he hated every moment of the chemo. Zach and his mom and everybody really talked him into it. And it just, he spent a month and a half in the hospital at one point earlier this year, with mostly effects from the chemotherapy, infections, sickness, things like that. And he finally, once he started to feel better, he decided that was it, that he just wanted to live the rest of his days and not deal with the chemo. And so, when you hear that, and Zach confided me in that about a month and a half ago, Zach knew what was coming. And the last 3-4 weeks, it's been really hard on the entire family watching JP decline. And you could see it on Zach's face the last 3 weeks, And not only has the team absolutely been horrific, but, that made it much more difficult for Zach to deal with everything, is that the team has sunk, so he couldn't come to the rink and have it be a solace. It was almost creating more stress in his life. And then watching his dad, deteriorate. So the other day we were in Dallas, and the Wild lost 7-1. And after the game, I had just heard before the game privately that JP, that they converted his den into hospice. So you knew it wasn't going to be long. And then after the game, they lose, and Zach just beat the crap out of himself for just the way that he's been playing lately. And he's just hearing this, and all along I know what's going on, but he doesn't know that I know what's going on. And it just coincidentally, I was going up to the press box and saw him about 40 feet in front of me, and I just kind of ran up to him and talked to him and kind of let him know that I knew. And he opened up about it and just talked about how just, this has been an absolute burden that he's trying to cope, but he is really having a hard time. And you just pray now now that he's back at the rink and practicing and he's going to play tomorrow, that he's going to be able to get back to some normalcy here. And you also hope, you guys know as beat writers, you got to stay objective and not root for the team, but you do hope that the team can somehow turn this around here to just alleviate some of the, absolute hurt that's going on in his life, because this has been an unbelievable downfall of this franchise this last month and a half, 2 months. And you just kind of hope that Zach can get away from everything that's going on off the rink and come to the rink and actually enjoy himself.
Mike, first of all, your work through this has been outstanding. And I know you don't do it for high fives, but really, you've really, I think, helped people understand what the Parise family has been going through all of this.
Thank you.
Give us a sense, Mike, of where JP Parise fits in the culture of hockey in Minnesota. Greg mentioned that's our QOD. For me, when I think of Minnesota hockey, three, maybe four names come to mind. Lou Nanny, Glenn Sonmore, mm-hmm. Ren Blair, and JP Parise. Where does he fit in the totem pole of gentlemen like this?
I agree with you. I mean, everybody, Lou Nanny's such a big part of hockey still in Minnesota. And it's such a great voice here. And obviously, Ren, he passed away fairly recently, actually. And Glenn's not doing well either.
Yeah.
I came to Minnesota after JP's time. And so, and it's kind of ironic because I grew up a huge Islander fan. And I was born right after, right around JP's time, but obviously couldn't remember it. When I really started to remember hockey, JP it was gone from the Islanders, in those early 80s. And so, it's kind of interesting that I've come to both places after the time, but I've grown an immense amount of appreciation, not just since Zach signed here, but, just getting to know him in the, 7-8 years that I covered the Wild before Zach came here, and just what he meant to the hockey community, what he meant to those old North Stars, to the people that still love that great franchise, and what he meant to Shattuck St. Mary's and all the great players that have played there and that he helped get there, from Jonathan Toews and Sidney Crosby to obviously his son. And so, but people just loved him. I mean, he was such a true character. A Heart of Gold, absolutely hilarious. You know, and again, when I think of him, I think of the character, that French accent. You know, I'm going to miss, seeing him at the rink, and I'm going to miss seeing him at the rink and getting phone calls from him where, you know, he's, you know, Jean-Paul Parisi. He used to call me Michel Rousseau. He joked that my last name should be Roussau, that I'm a Frenchman and not Italian, you know.
So, Rousseau.
Yeah.
That's great.
So, you know, and I've told this story in the last couple of days, guys, but just to show you, I mean, one of my lasting memories of JP is during training camp. You know, I had run into JP at the development camp in July, and it was very clear to me that he was not doing well, that he was under some sort of chemotherapy, because he was wearing a fedora, and it was just clear to me that he didn't have hair. So I knew something was up, and, you know, obviously I found out pretty quickly what was going on through friends of his. And, you know, about 2 months later, we're in those Octagon camps, those pre-training camps, and I was just shooting the breeze with Zach after one of the skates, and I kind of just let him know that I knew what was going on, and I asked him, you know, JP is so loved in this area, would he let me sit down with him and talk about what both of you guys are going through? And Zach said, you know, I'd be all for it, but I don't think JP would. An hour later, I got a text from Zach saying my dad would be willing to sit down with you. So about a week later, I was supposed to meet with JP at one of those camps during the entire skate, and he just never showed up. And afterwards, I'm interviewing players. Zach was out of the locker room, and he goes, just to let you know, my dad was taken to the hospital this morning, so he might have to put off the story for a while. He's not doing well. And so I'm like, absolutely no problem. Do not worry about me. And 6 p.m. that night, I'm just kind of lying on the couch watching TV. Phone rings, and it's JP Parisi. And I pick up the phone. He's like, Michel Rousseau, JP Parisi. And he's like, I'm sorry for standing you up today. And I'm like, no problem, dude. Like, what are you worried about calling me when you just, you know, I know that you're in the hospital right now. And, you know, just to me, I mean, that's kind of the way he was. He just, you know, everybody loved the guy.
Talk a bit about his Shattuck St. Mary's stint and his influence there. I think that's, you know, part of the story that obviously a lot of us know from the players that emerged from that school, but maybe a little bit hazy on exactly what he did for that program.
Yeah, he was basically, you know, he did coach there. Jonathan Davis said that he was the Bantam coach there one of the years that he was there. But he was the hockey director, and he was just kind of like, I mean, you know, from what I can gather, again, when I first got to Minnesota, I was actually doing a Sidney Crosby story, and I called JP down there, and he was still the hockey director. So he was the hockey director there for, you know, probably 2 or 3 years after I got to Minnesota, and I came here in 2005. But from, you know, at that point, you know, Coach Ward was already there and things like that. But from what I gather is JP was basically kind of the guy that helped bring guys in, but he was also kind of like the campus father. I mean, Jonathan Taves really told some touching stories yesterday about just, you know, what JP meant to players there, not just when they were struggling, but, you know, on the ice, but just when they were homesick, you know. I mean, this is a hockey factory, and, you know, they were getting kids, you know, 15, 16 years old from out of town, like Nathan MacKinnon, and that was after JP's time, but Sidney Crosby, and, you know, guys coming in from Nova Scotia, and, you know, it's easy for everybody to just consider that Sidney Crosby, right? I mean, you know, when you think of him now, but here's a 15-year-old, and, you know, and same thing with Jonathan Taves coming from Canada. And so I just think that he was kind of, you know, just a real beloved member there that, you know, obviously, you know, I remember talking to JP when Zach first signed here and I did my first kind of father-son profile, and he was telling about how, you know, he would just give the keys to the rink to Zach, and Zach would just hang out there with all his buddies till the wee hours of the morning. Wow. And things like that. I mean, you know, it's just you know, a bunch of stories like that.
When I think a lot of Canadians think of the name JP Parisi, the one moment that flashes into their minds is, you know, he gets the call against Alexander Maltsev in Game 8. You know, goes over to Kampala with the big, you know, tomahawk swing. Actually, you know the story about Kampala, right? With that famous picture with the tomahawk shot.
Yeah.
He has that picture in his apartment. Like, Joseph Kampala loves that picture. He has it hanging up on his wall. It's the interference call on Maltsev. And that's one of the burned impressions of J.P. Parise in this country. Good, strong, two-way player that was there to fish out pucks for players like Phil Esposito in that tournament. When I say J.P. Parise to you, though, Mike, what comes to your mind?
Well, exactly that. I mean, I love that YouTube video. I've watched it probably 1,000 times. and I know that it probably scares the heck out of anybody that's watching it. Like, what a madman. But to me, I just, knowing him, yeah, you know, knowing JP the way that I've gotten to know him the last couple of years, I just laugh every time I see it. You know, it's because I actually, you know, and JP told me that he was in full control, you know.
He was trying to
scare, like, you know, like a lot of people think that at the last second he just absolutely, you know, you know, gained his wits and realized he better not hit this guy over the head. But you know, I mean, that's kind of what I think about. I mean, I just laugh, and there's 1,000 stories. I mean, Tom Reed, who's the Wild color analyst and is going to deliver the eulogy at JP's funeral, tells some unbelievably hilarious stories about when they went to Vietnam and the things that they used, the practical jokes they played on JP, because he was apparently scared of everything. I mean, he tells great stories about putting, you know, bugs in his sleeping bag and snakes, and, you know, there's a great story that Tom Reed tells where, you know, they're roommates on the road, and JP's like, all right, guys, we got to go to bed, you know, big game tomorrow, whatever, and they were in adjoining rooms, and I don't know if it was JP's roommate or Tom's roommate, that was Bill Goldsworthy at the time. But either way, JP kicked them out of his room, and the door closes in between. And right away, Tom Reed realizes he never heard the latch click, so he knew that the door adjoining the adjoining rooms was not locked. So the second that he heard the click of the light, he snuck back into JP's room, and he kind of stood there for 3 or 4 minutes as he and his roommate are talking. And all of a sudden, they stop talking. He can tell that they're going to bed. He gets on his hand and knees, gets between the two beds, puts his hand under the covers, and grabs JP's ankle. So JP says to his roommate, who I can't remember if it was Bill Goldsworthy or somebody else, says to your roommate, like, you know, stop screwing around here. And then from the bed, the roommate's like, what are you talking about? And JP just jumps out of bed, freaking out, because somebody had hold of his ankle and he knew his roommate. It's stuff like that that I just absolutely laugh at. And just listening to the stories, again, Ryan Suter was talking yesterday about just him and JP in a suite during training camp. They share a suite, Zach and Ryan Suter. Mm-hmm. And he talks about just being alone with JP after his father died. And JP, in only the way that JP could do, was just telling all these funny stories just to make Ryan feel better, but not bringing up his dad, you know, like just trying to just make it like a normal type of conversation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the other cool part about that story in September, guys, that, you know, I wrote originally when JP was diagnosed, you know, when he announced that he had lung cancer, was that story was supposed to run 2 weeks earlier. And then all of a sudden, just tragically and totally unbelievably, cruelly coincidentally, you know, Bob Suter passes away, and JP was the first call I got, like, we can't run the story for a while, you know, because he just didn't want to disrespect what Ryan Suter was going through.
Mike, you mentioned Bill Goldsworthy a second ago, and I do wonder, because this was one of the first, I think, great lines for the Minnesota North Stars, was JP Parisi, Bill Goldsworthy, and Jude Drouin. Do people still talk about that line and have the sort of respect that they should for that line from the early to mid-70s?
Yeah, I mean, especially the last couple of days. I mean, my Twitter mentions talk about that stuff. And, you know, again, I'm not going to claim that I'm a historian on the North Stars. You know, I came here 10 years ago. You know, I'm only 40. My memories of the North Stars, excuse me, are, you know, Mike Modano and Neil Broughton and you know, obviously, Dino Ciccarelli. You know, I covered Dino in Florida. I covered Dino in Florida, and he used to just talk. And it's just so cool. You know, I talked to Dino about this since, how ironic it is that I'm covering the Wild now, because Dino used to just tell me North Star stories all the time. And so, you know, but I will say that just what the coolest part the last couple of days from my standpoint is just seeing all these great North Star fans come out of the woodwork and tweet me with just their JP memories the last couple of days. Hmm. And I will say that a lot of those emails that I've gotten flooded with emails, and I've gotten flooded with tweets, and everybody talks about those days and the admiration of those early North Star teams, and just again that line in particular, and just what JP meant. And, you know, again, because JP was before my time, you know, I never got to really watch him play, especially growing up in Florida, where, you know, you just don't get to see that stuff, and you know, hockey on TV and things like that, and you know, just hearing how good of a player he was in the corner and things like that. I mean, everything that anybody talks about JP Parisi, it just sounds like, you know, Zach Parisi, it just sounds like all those traits went to Zach Parisi plus you know, obviously more offense. And,
yeah.
And I will say just lastly, I mean, not to just go on and on, but the other coolest part of what's happened here in the last year is when Chuck Fletcher, you know, again, not to bring you back to that September story that I wrote, but one of the most amazing anecdotes in that story is, you know, Zach Parise gets back from Russia after captaining the Olympics, and his dad was already diagnosed with lung cancer, but he didn't know. His mom comes over and divulges this info to him, and Zach was completely numb and distraught. And the next day they were going to Edmonton, so he gets on the plane. He didn't want to go. He sits next to Ryan Suter. He's in just the worst mood ever. He's numb. Ryan's trying to get out what's going on, and Zach completely breaks down on the plane. And Ryan Suter goes immediately up to Chuck Fletcher and says, "We have to get J.P. Parise his own personal father-son trip. He's never done one in New Jersey in all the years that Zach was there. He's been diagnosed with cancer. We got to get him on a trip." So a couple weeks later, Ryan and Chuck Fletcher arranged for J.P. to come on his own trip to Phoenix, L.A., and Chicago last year, which coincidentally is the trip that everybody says saved the Wild season. They had lost a ton in a row up until that point. They go 2-0-1 on this trip. But in Phoenix, Zach Parise leads a rally and scores 2 goals to pass his father in career goals. And, you know, just, you know, you think about now just what a blessing that was that Chuck Fletcher and Ryan Suter made sure that J.P. got this trip because he was too sick to go on the Wild's father and son trip this season. It just is another one of those kind of things that really, you know, just makes you feel good about, you know, this organization obviously has a lot of flaws right now on the ice, but, you know, it just shows you how classy they are off of it.
That's amazing. Hey, flip it over to the Wild real quick.
Yep.
So Mike Yeo went crazy, huh?
What's that?
Who?
I said Mike Yeo went crazy this week.
Oh, yeah, practice. It was, hey, you know what? Usually you go to these practices and they're so monotonous, especially when every story is the same when you're absolutely awful. You know, every day I'm going to practice, like, what am I going to write about now? How am I going to change the tone of this? And then he goes crazy in that practice and, you know, rightfully so. I mean, it was unbelievable, just some of the scenes in that practice. They were so sloppy. They're throwing – I mean, at one point, Andrew Brunette, the assistant coach of the Wild, almost toppled over because 2 shifts in a row in the D-zone on breakout, defensemen put pucks right into his skate. And that's when Mike Yeo absolutely flipped his lid. That's when he actually stopped practice. It was the last time. It was actually the second time he stopped practice. And, you know, this organization right now is an organization under stress. They're the most disappointing team in the league, in my mind. Their goaltending's been brutal. And I think that was also part of the message that Mike Yeo was trying to convey that day. You know, after that loss the other night in overtime to San Jose, in which Darcy Kuemper gave up 3 or 4 bad goals, in my mind, you know, the tone after that game was blaming everything on Kuemper, not just in the room, but even Mike Yeo. And I think that Mike Yeo woke up, read what everybody was writing, and wanted to make sure that now, of all the excuses his team has had this year, from the mumps, the illnesses, to injuries, to heartbreak with its 2 biggest names, that now they're not going to use the biggest crutch being goaltenders, that we can't get a save. And so I think he wanted to just remind everybody that this is unacceptable to come to practice after a loss and practice like this when they're, you know, now 12th in the Western Conference out of 14 teams. I mean, nobody expected that, and they've got to figure a way out of this.
Normally a GM will give a coach who is in some trouble a trade to help him before he does the inevitable. You think Mike Yeo gets that?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, anything can change. I will say right now, and I know everybody, you know, scoffs at quote-unquote votes of confidence, right? It's usually the last straw before a guy's fired. This one I totally believe as of the moment we are talking right now. From Craig Leopold to Chuck Fletcher, they openly say this is not a coaching thing, that they have other flaws in this team that need to be addressed, starting with the goaltending. But, you know, if they keep on losing 6-7 games, you know, and going to the All-Star break, you know, looking like this is just going to be a death march, you know, I don't know how that changes things. If it were me, and just knowing the fact that this Wild team every single year loses just bad enough to always finish 10th, I would just say, the heck with it, stand pat, go with the unstable goaltending and just try for, you know, in a deep draft, try to lose as much as you can. That'd be me. But I don't know how that changes. I will say that I talked to Chuck Fletcher yesterday. He again gave Mike Yeo firm vote of confidence that this is not a coaching thing. But he also said he knows he has to make a trade. He's trying to make a trade. but he says that every trade that he has the ability to make from a, you know, say a getting a goalie standpoint, he's going to have to give up significant assets. And every time they continue to lose, it makes it less enticing for him to go and give up those assets, because it's not like a Cam Ward's going to come here and save the Wild season. So, you know, I would say that, you know, right now he might make a short-term fix on just getting a goalie in here at some point, but it might not be the one that everybody's going to want. And so, you know, I do think there comes a point here where instead of making a rash, knee-jerk type of trade right now and giving up a big asset, I do think that, you know, the one thing that is absolutely certain is the Wild cannot go into next season with Kemper and Backstrom as your 1-2 again. They've got to get a future number one. And so for that to be, you know, to me, to go and just make some crazy trade right now, if maybe there might be better options 2 months from now, 4 months from now, I think that's the smartest thing to do for this organization. But, you know, I'm not the one that's under pressure to lose, you know, have the arena go dark in April either.